I think it's quite fitting that my first action as a chief judge will be to cede to one of my colleagues the right to preside. Judge Lynn, would you please preside at this point? Because I'd like to make a motion.
First of all, I'm delighted to be on the panel with our new chief judge on the first panel as chief judge, and at this point, I would entertain your motion.
Well, I'd like to, Adam Stand, if you would, I'd like to move the admission of Adam L. Tukey, who is a member in good standing of the Bar of New York. Adam has served me magnificently and will, I'm sure, continue to serve the bar magnificently, and I would move his admission to the Federal Circuit Bar.
I enthusiastically endorse.
Chief Judge, your first act is unanimously approved.
Oh, can we make that a matter of repetition?
The motion is granted. Adam, welcome. If you'll please face the clerk, you can now take the oath of office.
Please raise your right hand. You swear or affirm that you comport yourself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States of America. Congratulations and welcome to the Bar of the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit.
Welcome, Adam. Chief,
thank
it's
you.
All yours.
Okay, our first case is Akamai Tech versus Limelight Networks. Mr. Dunn.
Good morning, and may it please the court. There are three broad issues on our main appeal. I'd like to cut to the chase and go to the joint infringement issue right away. And the basic question here is, does Muni Auction dictate the result of this case? We submit it does not, that the facts of this case are totally different from the Muni Auction case, as I will try to explain, that in this case, Limelight thoroughly exercised direction, if not control, over every aspect of the claimed invention. In Muni Auction, they not only did not direct anything to the claimed invention, but whatever direction there was minimal. Let me be more specific. There's only one patent involved on the joint infringement issue, the 703 patent. There are only four claims, 19 to 21 and 34, that are involved. And I'd like to focus on claim 34 at the beginning, which has only a single element dealing with the joint infringement issue, and that element is tagging. The parties stipulated as to what that word means. They stipulated that it means providing a pointer or hook so that the object resolves to a domain other than the content provided domain. The evidence shows that Limelight not only created the tag, it provided the tag. It not only provided the tag, but it instructed the content provider as to how to use the tag. It instructed the content provider that there are two ways to do it, prepending and scene aiming.
But didn't Muni Auction, just sort of directing your argument here, didn't Muni Auction exclude instruction from the joint infringement finding category?
Your Honor, Muni Auction has a statement in it about instruction, but BMC preceded Muni Auction and said instruction is proper. It focused on instruction. It also focused on a contract. I do not believe that Muni Auction intended to overrule BMC, because one panel can't overrule another panel.
But you're not reading Muni Auction as quite clearly saying that Thomson controls access to its system and instructs bidders on its use is not sufficient to incur liability of direct infringement.
And BMC said just the opposite. BMC said instructions, noted that there were no instructions in that case.
So does your prevailing here rest on our ignoring portions of Muni Auction because they're in conflict with BMC?
No, I don't think they're in conflict with BMC. All I'm saying is, under the facts of Muni Auction, you could well say the instructions were not proper. The instructions had nothing to do with the claimed invention. The claimed invention in Muni Auction was inputting data associated with at least one bid. There was nothing in Muni Auction giving instructions as to that claim limitation. Thomson, who was the key person there, did not create the bid, did not provide the bid to the bidder. While he instructed the use of the system, he didn't instruct about how to bid, when to bid. There was no mention in Muni Auction that there was a staff, as there was here, a staff on hand 24/7 to help, to instruct the content provider as to how to use it. I am saying that in the context of Muni Auction, you've got to read that language about instructions. And in the context of Muni Auction, instructions may not have been relevant. And I cannot read the Muni Auction language to suggest that it's overruling BMC, because it can't overrule BMC.
But in Muni Auction, the website had a space for you to enter bids. Isn't that kind of an implicit instruction as to how to carry out the invention?
Your Honor, my answer is yes, but let me amplify that answer. Muni Auction has some language in it talking about, it doesn't use the word continuum, it talks about a spectrum. But there's a continuum. At one end, there is arm's length transaction for involving cooperation. At the other end, there is direction and control. I suggest that it's a jury question as to which end of the spectrum we're on. It is not a bench question, it's a jury question. The question is there substantial evidence to support a verdict in Akamai's favor? And I suggest there is, because the degree of direction, the degree of control, it's as though Limelight was sitting over the shoulder of the content provider and saying, press this button, do this, do that. The direction was almost complete in that case, about every aspect of it.
Mr. Dunn, in the Limelight contract, whose responsibility was it to accomplish the tagging step?
Under the Limelight contract, the ultimate actual physical event of tagging was the content provider.
The contract specified that it was the content provider's responsibility to do that.
Here's what the contract says, Your Honor, at 17807. The customer shall provide company with all cooperation and information reasonably necessary for company to implement the CDS.
Yeah, and that's in the paragraph 2 that says
customer responsibility. Right, but it's under, actually, Limelight directed and controlled that event. It gave the customer, the content provider, the tag.
Well, on whose behalf is the tag added?
The tag is necessary. Without adding the tag, the system won't work. So the question is, on whose behalf? It's in order for the content provider to have access to this claimed invention, the content provider must perform that last step. But
under the direction, and it's the content provider's discretion as to which objects to tag and whether to tag or not, correct?
Once the issue here is, given a situation where the invention is being used, because that's what we're talking about, is there direction and control where the invention is being used? And I submit that once a user, the ultimate user, wants to get content from a content provider, the content provider does not have any discretion as to whether or not, the question is tagging, and does not have any discretion, has a contractual obligation to tag in the manner in which Limelight tells it has to tag.
So is this any difference of any relationship where a customer is required to create a username and password in order to use an online service? Is there any difference between that relationship and the one at issue here?
It's different in this respect, Your Honor. Again, I go back to the continuum. The continuum says, are we at this end or at this end? I am saying the degree of direction, the degree of control, if you parse the thing, sort of like slicing a salami, if you slice the salami thin enough, it doesn't look like a salami anymore. And all I'm saying is, when you look at the whole picture and you look at every step that is being performed, and you look at the involvement of Limelight in every step, you are all the way at the other end of the spectrum. You're not at the end of the spectrum where Muni Auction says it's not any good. You're at the end of the spectrum where there is direction, if not control, over exactly what the content provider is doing.
Is there any dispute that the case would rise or fall on this issue? I mean, if we were to find that there is no joint infringement, then all of the other issues here, including the claim construction, fall, correct? Am I correct?
Only as to the 703 patent, Your Honor.
Aren't the other patents implicated as well?
No, they're not.
Because it's just... The involvement is simply in the preamble. It's not
right. It's
not a separate step.
The other patents do not have this joint invention issue. And there's no dispute about that. The 645 patent and the 413 patent do not have that issue. So let me go on to the 645 patent. There are two issues I need to deal with. One is the 645 patent, claim one. Both issues involve claim one. And the issue is whether or not the word alphanumeric string includes the original URL. And I submit that the district court's finding that it does is inconsistent with the claims, it's inconsistent with the spec.
How is it inconsistent with the spec, which seems to use that as the one way, in fact, it describes it as the invention in several places?
Because the spec says at page 257, column 12, lines 47 to 49, the name of the original server preferably is included as part of the URL. Preferably.
That's one, but there's other instances where it says the invention and then shows the URL.
Your Honor, the word preferably appears throughout the spec. I think I counted 5, 6, 7 times where the word preferably is used. When a spec says the invention is, and then it says preferably it's done this way, I think that makes clear that it's not restricted to the one way. But moreover, during the prosecution history, the applicant characterized the alphanumeric string not to include the URL.
Then look at column 6, so lines 50 and column 7. According to the invention, the embedded object URL, according to the present invention, a virtual host name is prepended into the URL. I'm kind of lifting those.
This is column 6, Your Honor?
Well, column 6, 54 through 57, and column 7, 36 through 38. Both of those refer to the invention as the embedded object URL.
Can you tell me what lines you're looking at?
54 through, on column 6, lines 54 through 57, and then on column 7, 36
through
38.
Well, on column 6, the word preferably in the exact part that you're reading is immediately followed by two references to preferably. And the word preferably is all through here. I think you have to read the word the invention in the light of the statement that preferably it's done X. When something says preferably it's done, that means to me that it can be done another way. And that's consistent with the prosecution history where they characterized the strings without the full URL as...
If you don't have the URL for the embedded object, how does a content provider obtain the embedded object?
You can replace the object, you can replace the host name in the URL with the virtual host name. That's one way to do it. That's the simplest way to do it. And in fact, Limelight doesn't use the whole URL.
Can I just take you back to your answer to the Chief Judge's question on column 6 was that it uses the word preferably, but there's another reference in column 7, lines 36 through 39, which talks about according to the present invention, and there's no preferably limitation with respect to this particular sentence in the spec.
Column 7.
Starting at line 36. Thus, according to the present invention, a virtual server host name is prepended into the URL. I mean, there's no limitation here in terms of saying preferably.
Column 7 is part of the preferred embodiment. The title on column 5 is detailed description of the preferred embodiment. So whenever they use the word invention, I think reading this spec as a whole, they're talking about the preferred embodiment, and the proof of pudding is the language I read to you, and that is where it says preferably the host name, original host name, is retained. But that means that the original host name doesn't need to be retained, and that's exactly how LimeI does it. It doesn't retain the original host name. Now, I would like to just briefly talk about the other issue. Again, it involves 645 claim 1, selection by the alternate DNS. The question is whether or not the given name server, which is part of the alternate domain name system, must be selected by the alternative domain name system. There are multiple problems with that. The claim doesn't recite any selecting, importing at all. The claim only requires that the given name server be close to the client local name server. The district court's construction is inconsistent with the other claim language, which says that one or more DNS levels can be involved, and the district court's construction requires multiple DNS levels. While the district court came up with a proposal as to how it can be done with only one, the spec, the record, nothing in the record supports what the district court did, and moreover, I submit the district court system, her claim construction, requires two servers, both in the alternate domain name system, and therefore her construction is inconsistent with the claims. I see I have...
Thank you, Mr. Dunham. We'll restore your rebuttal time, and would you... give Mr. McKinnon an extra 4 minutes should he need to use it, and then we'll have equal time. Just 1 second, Mr. McKinnon, while we reset the time. Now you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. On the issue of joint infringement,
every time they exercise the option, there's infringement, right? Every time, if they decide they want to get information from a content provider, they then, by using the system, must do it according to the direction and control that they've received, right?
They have to follow the instructions. I don't believe they do it under direction and control, Your Honor. And the reason is that there is no...
The system only works if they do it as they're directed and controlled to do it.
As in... The Muni Auction case, Thompson had to follow the instructions if they were going to insert a bid properly.
Now, there wasn't instructions. There was a gap where a bid could be put, but there was no instructions. Moreover, there was no contract. Well, this has an actual contract.
Is there any difference between direction and instruction?
Yes,
maybe
I think
you can include that.
Okay, if I could address those questions. First of all, in Thompson, Muni Auction, there were instructions. The court stated in its opinion that Thompson instructs bidders on use of the system. That means they instruct them, how are you going to place a bid? You have to do it the right way. You have to go into the system, enter the bid in the right place. You can't just go into any place and enter a bid. You have to do it according to the instructions. If you don't put in the bid according to the instructions, it won't work. The bidder had the discretion, do I want to bid or not? Once it decided it was going to bid, it had to follow those instructions to make the bidding process work properly, just like here. If a customer...
There was a contract here, too.
There was a contract in Muni Auction as well. Both briefs to this court discussed the contract and said that the contract governed the party's relationship extensively. There's no doubt that there was a contract involving the bidders. The bidders had to pay if they were going to use the system, just like LimeLight's customers have to pay if they're going to have LimeLight deliver content on their behalf. In both instances, instructions had to be followed. It's no different than any other service provider. You have to. If the customer decides they want to use the system, then they have to follow the instructions. But LimeLight cannot obligate the customer to tag any objects.
What more could they do here to direct and control that's been done here?
Well, in a situation involving a typical direction or control, let's say in LimeLight's case, if LimeLight runs name servers, which it does, and it said to another party, we want you to run these name servers for us. We'll issue a contract to you. You promise will operate the name service for us. We will pay you some compensation for that, and in return, they do.
That's just making it a subsidiary. That's the limelight.
No, not necessarily. It could be an independent contractor contracting out, doing it on their behalf.
Sounds to me like that's making them limelight again. If you're going to retain separate entities, there's almost nothing more you could do, right? There's a contract, there's directions, there's instructions, and they give you the option. If you don't want to get into the system, of course, you don't have to. But once you enter the system, you've got to follow every step we give you.
I don't think it's entering the system. It's the user, the customer, has complete discretion as to whether or not they're going to modify a URL for a particular object.
If they exercise the option to tag, they've got to infringe.
Then they have to follow the instructions, just like a muni auction.
They infringe, and every time.
Just like a muni auction, if the bidders are going to use the system, they have to follow the instructions. And this court said those instructions are legally insufficient to establish
direction control. I think the instructions were much more implicit in muni auction.
The court said
there was a blank, but they didn't tell you.
The court said that specifically that at page 1330, that Thompson instructs bidders on use of the system. Now, with regard to the issue of the contract, and Judge Prost, I'll get back to the construction.
How do you reconcile the difference between BMC, the prior case, and muni auction?
I don't believe there is a difference. The only thing that BMC said was it mentioned the fact that there wasn't instructions and there wasn't a contract, but it didn't say what implication or what would have to be done in order for that to be controlling.
The whole point of this relationship is to practice the patent for the mutual benefit of both parties. Am I wrong about that?
I think the whole point of the relationship is to serve content on behalf of the customer. That's the purpose of it. What's going on here, Limelight is working for the customer. The customer isn't working for Limelight.
And so if they sued the customer, then there wouldn't be a problem, right? Because you're saying that Limelight is essentially a contractor for the customer in this.
Well, regard. I think it would be a different case. They have to run through those elements with the customer and say, does the customer have direction or control over each element? But certainly Limelight doesn't have direction or control over all the elements, and certainly not of what the customer does. If you look at this contract, because it's been mentioned a couple times, it uses very specific language. It says customers shall be responsible for identifying, and then it continues. The same language is used in the next sentence of the contract with regard to other things, and it says customers shall be solely responsible for operating its website, domain names, IP addresses, making sure its website up and running. Clearly, this isn't a promise by the customer to Limelight saying, we contractually promise we'll do all these things. Those are the customer's jobs. If the customer wants to
They do, with the caveat that if we want to use the system, we promise to do all of these things.
If we want to use the system, it'll be our responsibility. It's our job, it's not your job. We couldn't sue the customer if they didn't modify a URL. We can't sue them. In fact, the record is undisputed that there are numerous customers where the customer switches back and forth between Limelight and Akamai. If it were out of control, if Limelight actually controlled the situation, we wouldn't have our customers directing traffic to other contractors.
Well, you could sue them if they refused to pay on the contract, and you said to them, well, you didn't pay up what you owed us, and they said, well, all they didn't fail to do was to follow your direction.
If they didn't follow our directions, the system won't work, but we can't require them to do it in the sense that they say, we don't want to tag this object. We can't say, that's breach of contract, you're required to tag it. We cannot control them and direct them in that fashion. The question was asked, what's the difference between an instruction and a direction?
We just a minute ago both called them directions, because I don't think there is a difference between directions.
I think there is, Your Honor. An instruction is providing guidance, essentially, to someone. Says, this is how to do it. For it to be a direction, there has to be some authority to enforce the instructions. It's not just merely guidance. Kidding?
On every product you have at home, some of them say these are the instructions, others say these are the directions. Directions being, if you want to use it, this is what you're directed to do. Is there any difference between those?
I think under this test that the court's identified, yes, there is. And here's a distinction that I thought about. If this court told me to sit down, that is a direction. I have to do it. You have authority over me to do it. If I'm walking down the street and someone says, sit down, that may be an instruction to me. I don't have to sit down. It's my own choice and discretion. the same thing.
So it's not the word that makes the difference, it's the relationship. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, absolutely. The relationship that gives authority to that statement. And here, although Limelight, and your example of a consumer product where there's directions, I mean, the seller of the product can't force you to follow those instructions. I can follow them if I want to, I don't have to. And the same with Limelight's customers. They don't have to follow the instructions. If they want to make the service work properly, then they follow them. That's exactly what was going on in the Muni auction case with the bidders.
Well, the relationship here, though, may not necessarily be authoritative, but certainly the relationship is such that Limelight is specifying that to make the system work, this step, namely tagging, has to be performed, and is providing the directions to its customer on how to do that. So, why is that any different than if the contract specified in a separate paragraph hereby instructs and directs that in implementing this system you will conduct the following tagging step on Limelight's behalf in order to provide this mutually beneficial service?
I agree, Your Honor. If there was a contractual provision that says, I, the customer, promise to do this at Limelight's instruction, on Limelight's behalf, I retain no discretion. It's all, whenever you tell me to do it, I'll do it.
But isn't that, in effect, what this arrangement is?
No, I don't believe so.
If they're going to use the service, they have to follow the instructions, right?
But that's a big if. They've signed a contract with Limelight, but that contract is like an option contract. They have the option whether or not...
It isn't a big if, because the only time we're interested in whether they follow the method steps are those instances when they do. And that's even set out in the contract, which was not the Muni auction. There's no explicit instruction to follow each of the method steps.
We don't.
Whereas we have here, each of the method steps specifically set out as what you must do to obtain our service.
There are certainly instructions. I agree with that, sir.
And directions.
There are not directions because the customer retains discretion. If it doesn't do it, Limelight has no recourse.
But that's just saying if they choose not to infringe, they're not infringers. I agree. But once they choose to enter the realm of the method steps, then they are directed exactly how to do it.
But the key thing is they're choosing. They're the ones that are choosing whether or not they're going to do this. Not at our, we have no ability to require them to do that. It's just the bidders in Muni auction were exactly the same. They had the option whether or not they wanted to bid.
So I only infringe a patent if I use it. I sometimes choose not to use it. Sometimes I choose to use it. Obviously, I only infringe on the instances that I use it. It's no different than here.
Well, here it's different because there's a control or direction standard that's necessary.
Which is
for
clearly
parties.
Part of this by contract and by the terms.
The contract does not require them to do it. The contract allocates responsibilities between the parties. It says, these are your jobs. We, Limelight, are not going to be involved in things like running your website or your domain names, your IP addresses, or whether or not you're going to associate a new host name with an object. That's your decision. That's within your bailiwick. We're not doing it. If you do it, fine. If you don't do it, fine. We can't do anything about it. It's your choice throughout the whole process.
Well, it seems to me the question here is not whether that step is or is not performed and whether there is or is not infringement. The question is if the step that is specified in the claim is performed by the customer, whether that's attributable to Limelight, so that Limelight would be deemed the infringer of the overall method.
I think that's the same question, right? The same question that we had in Muni auction, where the bidders...
What about the jury? They weighed in on this and found against you.
It did, but Your Honor, the Muni auction decision was a question of law as well. It was decided as a matter of law. Under those circumstances, there could not be joint infringement, where you had instructions, we had a contractual relationship.
This is pretty heavily fact-dependent, too, as we are finding, right?
I don't believe so. The fundamental issues are not disputed. The question of what the contract says is not disputed. The question of that they are instructions is undisputed, and we've cited in the record testimony from both parties that these customers can decide which content delivery network they're going to send content to. We have customers under contract with us that aren't modifying all the URLs. In the same way, in Muni Auction, the bidders, it was undisputed that bidders could enter information which would infringe the claim.
You want this to be law. Isn't it a question of fact for the jury whether there's infringement?
Not under these circumstances, no. The facts.
Well, you have argued, have you not, that in the alternative we just should send it back for a new trial with proper instructions, right?
We have argued that in the alternative, yes, Your Honor, and we've also argued that there is an alternative ground for affirmance because of the tagging issue, we believe, was not interpreted consistent with 645 patent.
Can I just, before you get to that, turning you now to just the threshold question, do you agree with Mr. Dunner that even if you were to decide the joint infringement issue in your favor, there would still be remaining questions of claim construction on the two remaining patents, the 645 and the 413?
I think in terms of the status of this case, yes, but I disagree with Mr. Dunner to the extent he says there are not joint infringement issues in these other patents. The issues aren't ripened yet because the patents came up here on summary judgment or stipulations and we never got into develop that record. But under the holding of the 703 patent and joint infringement, I think absolutely there are joint infringement issues in the other two patents as well that require steps that are performed only by the customer.
But you acknowledge then that those records haven't been developed.
There was not
so we can't dispose of those.
I think that's right. All I'm saying is he said it's undisputed that joint infringement doesn't have anything to do with these other patents. It doesn't right now because the record isn't right. So we do need to get to the claim construction issues on the other two patents. Yes, Your Honor.
Switching to claim construction for a minute. Does the district court's construction require multiple DNS levels?
No, it does not.
Why?
Because the court explained that you can do it with a single DNS level. And I think what Akamai does is they confuse DNS level, the number of DNS levels with the number of DNS servers. You can have a single level DNS system that has two DNS servers at the same level, which is exactly what the district court said. The way you determine how many DNS levels there are is, does the user have to make multiple requests to DNS? If it makes one request for a resolution, the DNS does its thing and eventually returns the IP address of the content server, that's a one-level DNS system. The district court explained how that happened, because what you do is you have the user makes a request to the first DNS server on that level. It determines where's the close name server and directly goes to that name server without having to come back to the user. That close name server then returns the IP address of the content server back to the user, one level.
How does the Limelight obtain the embedded objects if it does not have the full URL?
How does it do it? It does it by a different method than the patent talks about. The patent, as I think one of the questions brought out earlier, the patent uses the original URL. If the content server doesn't have the object, it looks at that original URL, knows exactly where to go. It's a ready-made solution that's embedded into every one of those URLs. In the Limelight situation, Limelight has to create a table of all of its servers, thousands and thousands of servers, and in that table, it has to take host names and match them up to locations where objects are found. Very different, much more complicated solution and less inefficient, and actually more inefficient than what the patent talks about, which has this built-in solution by retaining the original URL.
Isn't this a classic case of conflating the validity and the infringement issues? I mean, isn't this a classic case where if the judge had two alternatives, and one of them was to reconstrue the language broadly, as the other side wanted, that may result in the absence of language in the specification in some written description or enablement problems, but it doesn't necessarily, or at least under our case law, is not supposed to infect our construction of the claims themselves, right?
Well, I agree that one is not supposed to do that. I don't think that's what the judge did. I think she was very careful to point to the places in the specification that referred to the invention. What happened here is the inventors very clearly specified what their invention was in several places. They used the language of the invention. They described only one way of doing it. They even, with regard to associating in the file history, told the patent office, this is the way we effectuate our invention by including the original URL. Now they want to say we're entitled to every way of doing it. even if we didn't invent it, even if we didn't describe it, we're entitled to every way of associating.
But all of the references you're talking about appear in the preferred embodiment. And as Mr. Dunner pointed out, at least in one of those, they talk about preferably a preferable method, which is the URL, but only as a preferable method.
I don't believe that here's another citation that I think, I don't agree with Mr. Dunner's characterization, but beyond that, if you look at column 4, for example, of the 645 patent, mm-hmm. Starting at line 16, it starts out with preferable. It says, each embedded URL is preferably modified by prepending a virtual server hostname into the URL. That is what they say there is preferable. But then it goes on to say, more generally, the virtual server hostname is inserted into the URL. You still retain the original URL, and that's what the judge's construction said. She said it includes the original URL. Her construction didn't require prepending or putting it somewhere else. She just said you have to have the original URL in order to make the invention work. And that's undisputed.
I'm going to have to hold you to your time, so do you want to save 30 seconds for your potential sir rebuttal?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dunner, you have 4 minutes.
Your Honor, I submit that Mr. McKinnon has given away the store. If I understood him correctly, he said if there was a contract, if there was an obligation under the contract, that would be a different story. Well, there is an obligation under the contract, and moreover, Limelight could sue if it wanted to under the contract. It might not want to sue as a practical matter, but it could sue, because once the content provider elects to use this invention, the contact provider is obligated. Customer, who is the content provider, shall provide company with all cooperation information reasonably necessary to company to implement the CDS. This is not an option. Once the user asks for the object, there's an obligation. There's a legal obligation it can be sued on, and I submit that should end the story. Mr. McKinnon also talked about...
Why, how can they sue the user? I mean, the user can choose not to do this. There's no way that it is legally liable to Limelight if it chooses just not to use the system at all, right?
But, Your Honor, it depends what you mean by that question. What you mean is, once the user asks the content provider for that information,
right,
the content provider is legally obligated to perform the tasks. Once it is used, this whole issue is, as Judge Rader, I think, correctly pointed out, we're talking about what happens when the system is used, not when the system is not used. Once it is used, there's a legal obligation. Limelight could come to me, though it probably wouldn't, it would come to Mr. McKinnon and say, Mr. Dunner, I'd like to sue. I'd like to sue the content provider.
Well, how would you breach that provision if you opted to use the system, then you would use some other instruction, or you would insert some other
host. You just not do it.
Well, if you don't do it, then you're not using the system.
But they are obligated once they get into the system, they have to follow the directions. They have to not only...
But if they don't follow the directions, it doesn't work, so they're not using the system. It seems a bit of a circular argument.
It sounds like a circular argument, Your Honor, now that you mention it. But the fact is that we're talking about using the system. And if they use the system, they've got to follow all the directions. They've got to do exactly what we have told them to do.
The question, though, is whether, you know, who is it that is performing that step? Is it the customer, or is it Limelight? Or is it the customer acting on behalf of or for the benefit of Limelight? Or in what respect is the customer's action in performing that step properly attributed to Limelight?
In this respect, it is attributed to Limelight because Limelight is the mastermind to use the muni auction language. Limelight is telling the content provider exactly what to do, when to do it, how to do it. It provides engineering. It provides quality assurance. It does everything it could possibly do without physically being there in person. Because of the modern age, it's able to do this electronically, but it doesn't.
But then it's up to the customer to do it or not.
Once the process is initiated, if the customer deviates from that process by suddenly saying, I don't want to do it, it's done some tagging, says, I don't want to do it, there's a legal obligation for it to do it because that legal obligation is in this contract. And Mr. Rainey told this court in Muni Auction that there was no contract in the record, contrary to what Mr. McKinnon said in Muni Auction. I see my time has...
Thank you, Mr. Dunner. I don't think we have anything for you to address, Mr. McKinnon.
I don't think so at the moment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our next